Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holly, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 19, NASDAQ Futures up 25. It's after a crummy day yesterday to the downside. It's kind of accentuated by the crypto move. And crypto made it actually traded below 73,000. It's back up to, let me see where the number is today, but it's back up to 75,991. And the Ethereum continues to go down. I don't know how many people have that versus Bitcoin, but do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning. Yes, you do.
How are you? Hey, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What did MicroStrategies, I use the term, used to do before they became just a Bitcoin collector at Leverage? Weren't they a software company or something?
That's a good question, and the answer is I don't know. I can probably tell you in a minute.
Because they are, the reason why this matters is yesterday was really a very unusual day, and I don't, you don't want to be one of these people that reads an article and thinks like the article set off a problem. That's a CNBC thing. We had a guy on here that said sell the market, the market's down, it must be because our guy said so. Well, not necessarily. So you can't really put yourself, market down 30% is Andrew leaves the can. okay. I guess they're coincidental, but that might not be causative, if you know what I mean. Anyway, but these guys, for whatever reason, this MicroStrategy, have become essentially a Bitcoin place, and they have something along the lines of 600,000 Bitcoins or something, Kevin? And a lot of them are on Leverage. And the rumor is, of course, nobody, it's not like I'm digging on their balance sheet. The rumor is that their cost number is like 76,000. If they get much below that, they've got a problem because there's leverage involved. And, of course, nobody knows how much, but this is dough word on dough street is 76,000 is kind of a key number. So as you saw, the Bitcoin sneaking under 76,000 yesterday, what do you think you saw? You saw the MicroStrategies is today it's down 92 cents. I'm going to say the stock was this thing traded $4.42. And last July, and it's now 132. Ouch. So I have no idea how much leverage. I have no idea. But one thing is sort of interesting. Whenever I look at the Bitcoin, you think of, all the people or expats that are hanging around and maybe some drug companies. drug people that have made a bunch of money. I guess, Kevin, give me your view, if you have one, because I just kind of thought about it. Last night, I went down the block to have a beer with my favorite attorneys, and I ran into some lady who said something about, what's the market doing? I said, well, market's kind of weird today, plus this Bitcoin. I think she's a waitress, Kevin. She goes, yeah, tell me all about it. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, I've got a bunch of Bitcoin. I go into these gas stations in areas that, I won't say are, they're not exactly Winnetka, and you see these Bitcoin vending machines. I have no idea how invasive are people who don't have an account at PTI or any place, or even a 401k at a bank, are they pouring money into these Bitcoin machines like if they're lottery tickets? I mean, I have no idea how widespread do you think ownership of this stuff is?
Yeah. I don't see him around here very much, Tom. So, you know, I don't know what to make of what your observations. There probably are some people who are doing some, you know, transacting business in cryptocurrencies. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you about that. It's, you know, there's like two Bitcoin ATMs around here. So,
I've seen a few of them. I don't see them very often. And I tell you what, they're nice machines. I actually did some research a few years ago about we could have bought one, Kevin. They were like 15, 20 grand. I mean, they're really, you know, they're and you can also use them as an ATM if Bitcoin ever went away, and just to pay bills. I mean, they're pretty serious machines, way more serious than just a regular ATM. The machine itself.
So your MicroStrategy's answer is started in the 80s as a software developer. At some point, they morphed into a company that got more into partnerships with large software providers and worked as someone who would help companies implement the large provider's software. They also have bought a whole bunch of companies, none of which are detailed on their website. Their history in the website, at least as far as I've looked in the last 2 minutes, have not especially gotten into detail about that. But they have arrangements with IBM, Microsoft, Red Hat. There's a bunch of them. BSPS Software, Apptio, number of companies. You know, Cisco, Lenovo. So they're a remarketer. Salesforce. So they're involved with a lot in addition to just their cryptocurrency stuff. And in fact, on the website, they really don't even talk much about it. But they probably. That doesn't mean they don't have a lot tied up in it.
They got 600,000 of them. That's a lot.
They looked at it as an opportunity to improve their capital position, and whether they did or not, and whether there's the liquidity they need or not, is another issue.
Well, if the rumored number of 600,000, 600,000 times 100,000, what it was, a lot of money.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that's a lot of zeros. Oops. Hey, yesterday, I mean, this is just observations, and to be perfectly honest, I mean, it doesn't really matter to me. I mean, I guess it matters because I do the show and I care. It's my living. It almost doesn't matter why something's moving. I just got to make sure if it's one of my people and they need protection, they're protected. But some things are kind of weird. Kevin, I'm not a massive fan of Ray Dalio, and I think Russell doesn't like him at all. I'm not positive on that. I will ask him before I... Should have asked him before I said that, actually.
He likes everybody.
Yeah. But this is an article yesterday by Chloe Taylor. And I just kind of read this because I've never heard this term before. So whenever you hear a new term, I got to dig into it, right? Legendary investor Ray Dalio said on Tuesday the world was on the brink of a capital war. He said central banks and sovereign wealth funds are already preparing for measures like foreign exchange and capital controls. This is according to him. Dalio was speaking on CNBC's Dan Murphy on stage at the World Government Summit in Dubai. And essentially he's talking about how we are on the brink. That means not in, but it means we're quite close to a capital war. It'd be very easy to go over the brink and into a capital war because there are mutual fears. And he's talking about escalating tensions, you know, a lot of them from our White House, but he warns that He says, warned of a fear among European holders of U.S.-denominated assets that they could be sanctioned and that there could be reciprocal fear on the part of the United States that it could not get the capital or not get the buy from Europe. And we've been sort of hitting around at that tension kind of a lot lately, Kevin, in the sense that our policy, whatever it happens to be, seems to be taking shots at people that we owe a lot of dough to. And the fear on our side is, what if they get pissed off and don't show up? And the fear on their side is, what if we decide not to pay or do something weird? I mean,
I don't think that's going to happen, but I do think you're going to see a policy shift when Kevin Warsh is in there, because he and Bessent are very aligned in this. But You know, in a recent speech, he said the Fed's financial stability responsibility should not give license to central bankers to be emergency capital providers. Capital allocation should reside, if anywhere, with the fiscal authority and its fiscal agency, the Department of Treasury. That's his comment. That's his belief. That's going to be the official policy because Bessent has a lot of sway in the administration.
If the market starts to go down and the Fed doesn't pour money in, the man in the White House is going to have a stroke. Because that's who do you think they're saving? The last two administrations, but every time they do that.
Well, what did he say in at the last cabinet meeting? You know, his comment was that his sort of dismay at the Fed's policy is that every time there's good news, anytime there's any kind of growth, they want to put the brakes on. Anytime there's any kind of slowdown, that they want to fuel it. And he said, you know, the good news should not mean Fed policy is to put the brakes on. Good news should be good news.
And totally ignorant remark on his case. Totally ignorant. Shows he knows absolutely nothing about.
It's totally ignorant. You may disagree with it, but it's not necessarily ignorant. Because it wasn't always that way.
It depends on which comes first. If you're pouring money into the system because the news has been crappy, and all of a sudden the news turns better, it's not like they've had a neutral stance, Kevin. That's the problem. Where do you start? The stance has not been neutral. If these guys were absolutely, and by the way, I would
take the position that that they shouldn't have been. They shouldn't have been fueling it all along either.
Well, okay, but they have been.
A dramatic shift in policy, but it sort of gets back to that, look, we're going to manage a stable money supply, neither up nor down, and of course we're not. You know, we're clearly not doing that. But neither up nor down. We're going to give it a certain growth rate per year, and we're going to stick to it. And, I think that's going to be Warsh's position. Whether it comes to fruition or not is another issue.
If he actually has that position, okay, there's one guy that you know would agree with him 100%, and that's me. I guarantee you, if that's his position, he'll be out of there in 6 months. Because that's not the president's position at all. He wants more money into the system. He wants inflation.
I don't know if he wants inflation. You know, personally, I get that. You know, what you always say about, you know, his personal benefit to it with, and any real estate developer for that matter. I get what you're saying. But on the other hand, if the whole idea is to try and fuel growth, well, what did I tell you last week? What did I tell you was the key number to watch, to be watching more than just about anything else, and that includes money supply.
Well, you like the ISM, and I.
Well, because it's important. Because
I think it is too. I'm with you.
And I've said this before. What they're trying to do is sort of reshape how trade works, you know, throughout the world as it pertains to the United States. They're trying to reshape it. Whether they're going to succeed or not, whether they're doing the right things or not, doesn't really. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that's what's happening, and you know, to a certain extent, make yourself a bowl of popcorn and sit back and watch, because that's what they're doing.
I don't.
But and what I'm telling you also is, we had a really strong ISM report of manufacturing activity last month. 1 month is not a trend. 1 month is an observation. You know, if they do it 6 months in a row, cool. That means that that there is some reshaping going on. But there's also there's a number of really, really interesting things happening in the manufacturing world, like graphite processing that we haven't done in 70 years in this country. John Deere setting up an excavator factory in North Carolina. We haven't made excavators in this country for 50 years. Aluminum smelter going up for the first time in 15 years, and that's in Oklahoma. So there's a lot of really, really interesting manufacturing activity happening of significance, as well as, you know, smaller manufacturing operations that are a little more nimble and are able to set things up quickly. So, you know, I don't know how this is going to work out. I have no idea. It may all totally crash and burn.
Well, I don't want it to crash and burn.
This is the time we destroyed the republic, but there are some changes happening, and it popped up in manufacturing activity this month, I don't know if that's going to continue or if that's just a one-time observation.
I would hope it continues because we've gone the other way for way too long. Good
Lord. Yeah, we absolutely need it to, because with everything else going on, if we don't have actual growth in activity. Now, remember that they had some interesting summary statements in the report, that they always put at the beginning, and it's new orders growing. That's good. New orders from American manufacturers. Production growing. That's good. Employment contracting with all this growth going on. That's kind of interesting. Don't know what to make of it. Supplier delivery slowing. Concern for that. You know, what's going on with that? Does that mean, supplier imports? Or is that just mean we have a time lag to have more suppliers setting up shop in the United States? Don't know. Raw materials inventories contracting. That makes sense. If you're increasing production, you're going to be depleting your raw materials inventory. You don't have things sitting around waiting for you to do something. Customers' inventories too low. That would also indicate that orders have to come up, and that's good. Prices increasing. Yeah, we know that. Imports unchanged. Okay. Exports growing. So it's kind of those trends in the economy are an interesting mix, but they aren't as contradictory as they have been in recent months.
I actually went through the report yesterday because you sent me the thingy, and it seems a little conflicting. The employment part's good. The part that I'm having a problem with on all this stuff, because I just was looking at God love them, is actually I've been working off the monthlies on the money supply numbers, and Hal has actually been working off the weeklies, and his view of how bad things are is actually way worse than mine according to the weekly, because he put some kind of a log normal growth on the thing or something. I'm looking at the, and my concern is when we lob these numbers out there, we say anybody who does it, you know, the ISM type of thing, you know, it the thing that really, when it gets down to the production, it gets down to everything, and a lot of these numbers look pretty good, like you say, Kevin. Plus, I like the part about the customer inventories are way down, which means that they should be buying, right, coming forward?
Yeah, it absolutely means they should be buying. So it's a good thing.
And the backlog is up a little bit. The backlog is up to 50, over 50 for the first time in seemingly forever, doesn't it? Which mm-hmm. is, you know, backlog of orders, which is, you know, duh, that's what you want to have, right? I mean, there's a lot of but then they show the prices pretty much unchanged. And I would like to talk to somebody, Kevin, and I'm not just poking holes at this because you said it was a good report. It is a good report. But I wonder what it even means if your pickup truck is 85 grand and 4 years ago it was 60. I mean, I don't know how you account for that. Whether you're actually talking about widgets or you're talking about the price of the widget times the widget. And I really want the number to be widgets. I think you do too. I mean, and I don't have a feel for that. I get the feeling things are getting better. I just wonder how much.
Yeah, and I think that falls under the category of time will tell.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say other than good. You know, like I said, good report. Very happy to see it. Let's see what next month looks like.
Let's see what
after it looks like. And that's I think is going to, you know, if we start to establish a trend in that direction, I'll say good. That's a good thing. I just don't know what to make of it yet.
Well, we're also coming from, unless you, and I'll get this in a second, Kevin. It's buried in here somewhere. Where am I? I'm going to the debt clock here, which I usually do when somebody drives me there. There we go, debt clock. We're the numbers Kevin's talking about. I mean, we're so far behind. We can't even sniff the, you know, the dog in front of us is behind at this point. But the manufacturing jobs today are 12.6 million. Manufacturing jobs in 2000, when we had a lot less people, were 17.3 million. So we need a couple of mil in there just to say we're starting, Kevin, which doesn't mean that the journey of 1,000 miles always starts with one step, right? I mean, it's not like you, but it's, I mean, we're way behind. I mean, let me see where this down, if I can figure out where this got down to. Do you think it's up from a few years ago? I don't know. Let me look and see. Let's go back to What I say the number? I can't get this all on the same page. This page gets so damn big.
My guess is it's not. It's not going to be. If it's up, it's not substantially up, because the way we make things has changed so much.
I'm going to say, okay, 2020. Of course, it's all in a different spot, right? Imagine that. Disabled, living in poverty, population. I don't know if they have a number here for then. Oops. For manufacturing things. I don't think they had one. In 2020, the things managed to... they keep more and more in there, but then they don't always go back on the other stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, last week we discussed, you know, I drag out a speech that Vance made a year ago, but Lutnick made essentially the same speech at Davos, that, you know, this idea that we farmed out innovation along with all of these low-skill jobs, and I absolutely agree with that. I think when you consider what innovation is about, we tend to think of it as product innovation, you know, what's new, what's different, what's, et cetera. But really, as much as anything, process innovation is just as important, in many ways, more important. So when you send the work someplace else, you send process innovation with it, because it's going to happen where the work is done. And so I think that's a big deal. Now, anybody who is intent on producing and manufacturing in the United States is going to have to do it with a different kind of process, because you're not going to match the labor numbers you get in the Far East. So instead, you're going to have to invest in a lot of automation. And that's why I said, I don't know what the job situation is, how it's really going to shake out. I think you have to identify the skills you need to be a survivor in that kind of an industry now. And that's, you know, that's an interesting academic discussion that we can have. I have it all the time with students, I don't know how that's going to translate into the employment numbers. It should go up if we are really juicing manufacturing in this country, but, you know, is it going to go up as dramatically as one might expect? Is it going to match is going to match the growth in production? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, it depends. The first one, I really, you know, for somebody who spent 3 years working at a place that made railroad cars, the idea that, and I'm not saying he's wrong, he's right, Kevin, the idea that somebody has to actually get up and say, by the way, if we don't make railroad cars anymore, we're probably not going to be innovating in how we build them.
It's almost like you say, duh.
Yeah, like duh, of course there isn't, you idiot.
But at the same time, that's what we did.
Yeah, that's what we did.
You know, that was some of the excoriating the Europeans and saying, you guys have decided to go to net zero and go solar and wind, and you don't make a damn bit of all that stuff. You have to get, you know, you're counting on that to be produced for you by the Chinese, and you're, you know, in the meantime, you know, when you want to go to natural gas, you're counting on the
Russians. All right, but before you,
good luck. That's going to be a great long term strategy.
Before you take a pot shot, which you just did, at the Europeans, which, by the way, we should, you know, it's no problem with that.
The United States has done it too.
Okay, we if I would guess that there are, well, boy, this is you should be asking me this question, because I know one doesn't know the answer. You probably do. If you compare, say, a 99 Chevy pickup with one today, I would bet you that there's 400 parts in there, little motors in the seats that now move all over the damn place, stuff that heats the seats, stuff that heats the steering wheel.
All the computer control stuff.
But not just the computer control, all the little motors that move the seats, all that crap. 98% of it is not made here.
Agreed.
Which, so we can blame the Europeans all we want, but we're doing the same thing.
I'm not blaming the Europeans. I was using the Europeans as a different example.
And, you know, the thought of even us, I don't know that is there any money in that stuff, Kevin? Would you and I ever want to build a factory to make little tiny motors that move seats and shit around in a truck or a car?
I do believe there's money to be made at it, but you have to be You have to be really lean, and you probably have to have a very, very high degree of automation where you're not going to recover your investment. On margin, you know, your gross margins are going to be very positive, and as long as your gross margins are positive, then you have to decide that you're comfortable, maybe getting a 5-year payback on your capital expenditures for automation rather than a 18-month payback. And if you can live with that, you can have a very solid long-term business and be in a position where you can provide a virtually uninterruptible supply chain to anybody who wants to who wants to use those parts.
Here's I was watching a YouTube yesterday. By the way, we can't stop talking before I have to rant at somebody. It's going to have to be you. The Bulls. How the hell can they charge for a ticket on that team I just watched last night? But I'm not going to do that now. Let's do that later.
They have like 7 guards on the team now. They're going to have to make enough. They're going to have to trade again this before the deadline.
Can you tell what position people are even playing? I've never seen basketball like that. They used to play 4 days a week.
They were announcing 6'3" forwards in the starting lineup.
I don't know if you probably don't watch this, but of course me, I was drawn to it like a bear to honey. YouTube had a big 20-25 minute thing, and Amtrak is going out for new cars, and whether they're going to do more superliners or single levels. And I'm sitting there, Kevin. They're going to do it again. They're going to go out for, like 300 cars, and then not buy them again. Well, which is an unfair statement, but because they've had them refurbished, and they actually had gone out, and some people have made some new ones. But these are the cars that were made at Pullman when I was there. That's how old they are. Well, the original ones. And I listened to this, Kevin, and I'm going, we're not going to do this again. Please, somebody hire me as a consultant. I'll work for free. We got to change this bus around, for God's sake. We need, let's say you go to double, the debate is the double-deckers, the superliners, they go points west, okay? And they love them on the trips, you get a nice view and blah, blah, blah. They've been terrific cars. They're 120-mile-an-hour cars, which I bet they never go over 80, but still, they're 120-mile-an-hour cars. And then on the east part of the country, you have single level. Now, the reason for that is, there's tunnels in the eastern part of the country that the big ones won't fit in. And not so much they won't fit in, but if there's a curve in the tunnel, the superliner might lean over and tap the side, which you don't necessarily want to have to happen, right? But, yeah, there's places I don't think a superliner can get in Penn Station. Matter of fact, I'm positive it can't. Those kinds of things. So they're trying to figure out where they should make the whole system and how the system has been, you buy a bunch of cars, and I'm going to sit there. I want to grab somebody by the neck, Kevin, and I want to say, let's work on a new design. Let's get an American factory. I'd love to have it in Chicago. God, I'd love to have it in Chicago. Let's get this ball rolling. Let's get some people. Let's make a few. Let's do it right. Let's get everybody, the people together. Let's try and make 4 a month. Once we get rolling, not 10, not 15, maybe even 2, and at the same time, let's run the first group back through a rebuild one more time, and get them another 20 years. What I want to get to, Kevin, is if the cars last 30 years, okay, and we have 500 cars or 600 cars, what is that? That's 20 cars a year, right? So we need to make 20 a year, and at the end of 15 years, you want to bring them in for a full refit. I want to be on that kind of a schedule. I don't want to buy 400 of them and then 40 years from now going, hey, we don't have any freaking railroad cars. I mean, there's such common sense to this that I don't seem to get. Or maybe I get and they don't because I worked in a place. Why don't we have people that
have to manage their inventories? And I suspect I don't know this, but I suspect Amtrak is probably operating on a cash accounting basis rather than accrual. So, as a result, what happens to them? They want their budget to be they want to spend their budget money on anything except new cars. until they have to, until they're forced, and then they want to go back for a special appropriation on that.
Yep.
And you know, get it done that way. In the real world, especially if you have to report net income to a stock exchange every quarter or annually or whatever number you want to put on it, you want that depreciation expense to be a flat line. Maybe it grows a little bit as your company grows, but by and large, you think of your depreciation expense line as a flat line. So whatever duration you put that property onto the books to use, you know, I don't know, you know, is that like a 15-year property? How would you do that?
I would think they're easily a 30-year property, but you would probably want a full retrofit halfway through.
Yeah, so something like that. Hey, you know, looking at it for computers and servers, I wanted a third of them, because we put them on as three-year properties, I wanted a third of them to come off of the books every year, so that I'd go out and buy more, and I'd have, you know, I would have the same depreciation expense every year, assuming no growth, because I could make them five-year properties. I can do all kinds of things with them. I can make them last for 5-6 years. But the problem is, then they're going to drop off the books. Depreciation expense is going to be very low. Everybody's going to be very, very happy with me until I go back after year six and I have these computers that are barely limping along and I have to replace them. And all of a sudden, my depreciation expense is going to go way up. And then everybody's going to be very unhappy with me. So you have to manage the fleet like that. And that's just prudent. That's just the right way to do it.
And you say, other than my affinity for a city that I'm not all that happy with now, why Chicago? Well, because I'm going to say virtually not all, and certainly the ones that run up and down the corridor and the East Coast, virtually all the Superliner cars, if there was a retrofit needed, all of them could be routed through Chicago, right?
Empire Building. Chicago Central, as far as the the industry goes. Chicago would be great. The second biggest switching yard in the country is in Elkhart, so you could bring them over here too.
Well, what I'm saying is if all of a sudden you had a retrofit of some kind, not to cause the train to not run, you could bring the train into Chicago, pull it down to your yard, take the 2 weeks, retrofit those 8 cars. If all of a sudden there was an upgrade of the air conditioning system or something you wanted to put in there, and bring them back to Union Station. I mean, they're right here. But the part that I've, you're always looking at, not you personally, but the numbers and the depreciation schedules. What I've found, Kevin, is if the numbers drive you away from the logic, the numbers are screwed up, or not screwed up, but the tax basis is screwed up. Somebody's screwed up. You should think first of all, what makes the most sense here, I would like. That's why your CTA cars should be made here or assembled here. Because if there's a retrofit, if there's a problem, if you're gonna bring them in for their 12-year redo, you want to just drive them down there and drop them off, don't you? isn't that the?
No. I want somebody overseas to.
I want somebody overseas to do it. I mean, I don't. This whole thing, I just don't get it. The reason why a lot of this stuff comes from. The CTA cars are being assembled by a Chinese firm down on the south side somewhere. Why? I mean, why do the part of it is, Kevin, is the authorities, the companies here, the authorities put every one of these car companies out of business. They put St. Louis Car out of business. They built the R44s, which is the subway cars, before Pullman built the R46. They put Pullman out of business. They beat up on these manufacturers, and they sue them. But if you come from overseas, they can't beat up on them. The Chinese were, what did they overrun on the Bay Bridge, like 3 or 4 times? You can't sue them. How are you going to sue them? How are you getting money out of the Chinese government? Yet if it was here, they couldn't wait to sue the guys, right? And the problem here were change orders from Amtrak. And Pullman did not have the ability. They had a bunch of old car knockers. They didn't have the ability to. They could have used a Kevin O'Neill. Oh, God, I can't say anything nice about him, but I will. A Kevin O'Neill. Actually, we had a couple of Kevin O'Neills there, but nobody listened to him. Kevin O'Neill could have saved Pullman $500,000 a car, because they had no idea about process and manufacturing and having people there to work that couldn't work. The authorities up these what do you want to call it, the bidding contract, they upped the contract to such a point where the people on the other end, meaning Pullman or St. Louis Car or Bud or Boeing, didn't even know what they were reading, Kevin, and the stuff that in the timing on things. So they got buried by the timing, got buried by change orders. I mean, Pullman would do stuff, because I did some of these. Pullman, they would say, we wanted these seats, and they were $800 a seat. We don't want those seats anymore. We want these other seats, and they're $900 a seat. So we would sit there and we would go, okay, the old one's $800 and the new one's $900, and that's $100 a seat, plus we'll put some overhead on it. We had no idea, Kevin, collectively, and I was very young, and I didn't know enough about the process, or I would have said, hey, assholes, getting the old seats back to the place and getting the new seats in, by the way, we've already got them in 15 cars, we're talking about 15 days delay, and it's costing us $1 million a day in this plant. And the authority would have said, wait a minute, you want $15 million to change the seats? What's the matter with you guys? There would have been nothing the matter with us, Kevin, because that's what it cost. And we had probably 50 of these change orders. We had no idea how long it was going to take in terms of, 300 people working there, and all of a sudden the thing doesn't move down the assembly line because you're changing out seats, which you put in yesterday. We had no concept of how much this stuff would change us, because in the old days, it was real easy. It was, you put the seats in, you had an inventory of them, you put these other ones in, what's the difference? Once you're ongoing, this would have been a job, if we could go back in time, this would have been a job, the biggest job ever for Kevin O'Neill, because you could have helped these guys out more than anybody. They had no idea what it was costing people when you actually had people working like that. And your flow per day was, X number of millions of dollars. It was scary.
And the part that's being missed in the logic behind this is that it does make sense to be concerned about the well-being and capability, process capability of your suppliers. You tend to think of it as almost an adversarial relationship, and I don't mean that, in terms of, like you have the daily food fight, but more along the lines of, how can I squeeze the most out of these guys? And when in reality, what you really need to be doing more than anything else is you need to have a decent partnership out of this, so that you can all say, okay, what works for you? What works for me? Here's what I need. But, try going and building a new house, even, in a spec house in a subdivision, and try going in there, and 3 months after construction starts, saying, here, I want to make some changes. What's going to happen? That's exactly what you're describing. Okay, it's going to take me another 6 months to build your house, and it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. If you had told me this right up front, we could have spec'd it out, and we could have saved you a whole hell of a lot of money. Well, that's, that's really what you're doing when you're throwing these last-minute changes in, and you're just not showing any. It's almost disrespectful to your suppliers when you do it that way. It's just like saying, here, take it or shove it.
Well,
unfortunately, government does that because government is the only place, the only people that are going to buy rail cars. So,
well, the people who do this, and I'm not, it took me a while to understand, Kevin. So it's not, it wasn't like I walked in the door and was. It's anything you do, and you do it instinctively, even though you don't label it as this. If you and I were going to have this plant today, to people that, I'll bet we could still get some people to do the engineering and the drawings. The manufacturing engineering guys, I don't know where we'd find them. No, what do? They look at the drawing and they say, oh, here's the side of the railroad car. That's pretty interesting. Looks pretty nice. They're the guys that tell you, here's how you start. You take this part here and this part here, and by the way, you bolt it together. And then you take that one and bolt it onto this one. You weld that. Those are the guys that give you the process. Otherwise, they're the guys that tell you, wait a minute, you dig the foundation first, you idiot. But here's what absolutely has to happen, Kevin, and I on a base level, I think you talk about it in your classes. What has to happen for something to be accomplished? Any kind of an operation, they used to call them. You need Andrew at work sober, right? you need the drawing to tell you need the drawing to tell them, or the engineering or the manufacturer, the operation, that somebody has to pick up part A and part B, which both have to be sitting in front of them, right, or on the line, and they have to be attached by bolt C, which screwdriver D. So you need Andrew, you need the two parts, you need the bolt, and you need the screwdriver. If you don't have any one of the five, you're screwed, right? It is so difficult to get all that stuff together, and that's what Pullman learned over 100 years. Here's your purchasing guys. When do you need it? And their job was to get all that stuff there in time. When Andrew shows up for work on a Thursday, there's a stack of these parts, a stack of those parts, a stack of bolts, and by the way, here's his screwdriver. If you don't have all that stuff, you're going nowhere, right?
Sounds like a logistics function to me.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't change, does it? Now, if you want to get fancy, if some parts, I'm looking back on how they built the Boston cars, someplace you probably could have, since there were only 60 cars, you put all the parts on a big, they call it a jig, and it has to be, everything separated, it has to be done just right, and then people weld all the parts together, and then all of a sudden you have an underbody of a car. I don't know what the break-even would be, Kevin, on making that all robotic. I'm thinking for 60 cars, it might not be, for 30 cars, it surely wouldn't be. I don't know what the break-even on that would be, to make the thing totally robotic, like a automobile assembly line. Some stuff you could do that, probably. But some of the welding is so precise, you know, I don't know, do you really want to get...
If you want precision, then you will go to robotics.
Those people were pretty good. Matter of fact,
I understand.
They only had...
People have more variants than robots.
Well, we'll leave the train talk for some basketball here, but you know what the toughest weld was, Kevin, was... The Amtrak Superliners we're talking about, all you do is drive Chicago, and you really see them anywhere driving on a track. The end weldments were all Corten, which is, you know, I won't say basic steel. It's a real high strength, I'll use the term regular steel, if there is such a term. The center post was stainless, and they had to be welded together. There were only two or three guys in the plant of all those people that were capable of doing that. That had the touch, because your stainless steel melts easier, right? It has a much lower point of where it melts than the other stuff. So you had to be just, you know, 2 seconds on one, 3 seconds on the other. And if those three guys either didn't show up or were hung over, you didn't weld them that day, because nobody else could even try it. That's how good they were. Now robotics maybe could fix that. I don't know, but I'm saying there's some pieces to this. But only a few people. You look at the electrical component, electrical box. I mean, you look at one in your basement or your backyard or whatever, not backyard, your back room. What is it, a big jumble of wires? You look at one in an Amtrak car. You'd swear to people, and they were artists. There are so many wires, and they are folded just perfectly. And you look at it, and you go, my God, who did this? It's a whole different world than your house. Just saying.
Yep.
Anyway, what exactly, if you've got a skybox for the Bulls now, what are you doing? You can't pay somebody to go there, can you? Unless, I guess if you feed them and drink them enough, you might. But
it's strange. The Bulls are one of the league leaders in attendance and have been for a long, long time.
I think their prices are got to be one of the top five, too.
Yeah.
I mean, what is...
And yet the product has not been very good for a long time.
Hey, I'll ask you the question. It's not only not good, Kevin, it's hard to watch. I don't even think those people know what they're... What is the infatuation with this general manager and Billy Donovan? That looks like... I've seen people play in a park with more organization than those guys play. I can't even tell what position people are.
The thing is, early in the season, they were playing a very good brand of basketball.
Yeah.
And suddenly they stopped.
Well, the only guy in a team that has any fundamentals whatsoever is the guy that he's got rid of, Vucevic. I'm happy for him. He gets those Celtics. Maybe he can win something.
Oh yeah, he gets to go to a contending team, a team that's trying to win. He's got an expiring contract, so he wasn't coming back. Plus, he's older anyway. So I'm glad they got something for him. But
I
think they have finally, after a lot of years, have decided that the mix that they have ain't working and it's not going to work. So I think they went out and said, okay, we're going to start trying to reshape this team.
But they've been doing it for the whole offseason. The whole offseason, they needed a big guy. Yet they let the one big guy go to Philadelphia. And they got rid of this Kevin Huerter last night. He's one of the most fundamental guys. Why get rid of him?
Because they could get stuff for him.
But what did they get? They got a couple second-round picks.
No, they got Jaden Ivey.
Who's he?
He was the number five pick in the draft for a few years ago. He's from Purdue. His mother is the Notre Dame head coach. Notre Dame women's basketball head coach. He's had several injuries, so, you know, they're kind of on a prove-it basis with him to say, are you back? Are you healthy? Because I think he's restricted free agent after this year, and they'll have to decide whether they really want him. But either way, they're either going to clear space.
Well, they got rid of their one biggest guy who wasn't big enough. Do they have anybody big anymore?
I don't think so. They have like seven guards on the team right at the moment. So that tells me that there's going to be more happening with them today.
Well, we'll see. I started the show, and of course you got me off on railroads and systems, which I guess both of us like to talk about. But not just the market yesterday being down so much, but what did you make of my observation that every one of the people that, well, I look at these because I have a lot of stock that I'm protecting from people in these companies, and all they're doing is going down, Kevin. I mean, it's this anything international in terms of consulting, and I put IBM in that loop because they do a lot of stuff overseas. Those companies are all in the crap hole. I mean, it's Accenture. Are they ever going to get another contract? I mean, they do a lot with governments too, I think. Are they being restricted somehow? I mean, something's crazy. I mean, you look at what the stuff that's moving and what isn't.
Well, I don't know of any policy restrictions that are...
I don't either, but what is there? It seems like everybody's... I think the Bitcoin's causing some kind of a problem, but I don't think those guys are ever paying, like, Bitcoin or anything. But, you know, I honestly look at this and I go, this seems a little strange. Why? Plus, IBM has been such a horse to the upside, and yesterday it was down $30 at one point without any kind of news whatsoever. You know, I mean, 10% move in a stock is a lot, especially we're not talking about somebody put together yesterday. These companies have been around like kind of a while. 10% moves are huge deals. Mm-hmm. Today we were up when we came in. Now the S&P futures are still up 10, but the Nasdaq's are down 42. We had gold and silver flying back to the upside again after that huge drop in silver. I keep trying to on the show every once in a while, Kevin, to talk about, you know, the trading part of this. The day last Friday in silver, a one lot at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, if you were short a one lot or long one lot of a silver contract, down $30. One lot is 5,000 ounces. And 150 grand in a one lot? What the bleep? Over? It's kind of a lot, don't you think?
Well, so what's the question? Is something happening that is, you know, kind of a market shift that's going to last for some time, or is it just a weird month? You know, I don't know.
If you have a stock that you've owned for forever, and it seems like, I don't know if some of this stuff's too high. Does it mean some people mean that the whole market is vulnerable to some 10 or 20% drop suddenly? And I'm dying to get Larissa and. Because she's teaching.
Russell's in. He can opine on this.
Okay, you know.
And she's not coming today. Well, first off, the most actively traded silver contract is I think it's a smaller size than that. Okay. You know, they have minis on everything now, so I think it's smaller than maybe the micro or whatever they call that all the retail people can trade. So.
Okay, but I'm saying it's still.
I can't believe how little the freaking margin requirement is on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they just raised it three times, and it's still, what, only 25 grand?
Well, Bloomberg shows it at 13.
Yeah, and that's up like three times in the last month, right?
Yeah. Well, it should be.
Well, yeah.
I mean, why not? So.
Well, I mean, the same investment in the SLV, which is what our people are in, which is the ETF, margin on that's 50%, so it's a lot different.
Yeah. I believe there's some leveraged ones now that you could use if you want to get a little bit more juice in the equity space.
Do you need juice with 30% moves?
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Let's light this candle.
Hell yeah.
Oh God,
that's what it's all about, man.
What the? So, quick question on you. What do you think the retail? I say retail people that maybe don't even have a brokerage account. What do you think the retail penetration is of Bitcoin? And Kevin didn't know, and I don't know. Yet I talked to some people last night that I think might have been, not disparaging anybody, might have been waitresses. And they go, yeah, we all got some. I go, you got to be kidding me.
Really?
Yeah.
Smarter than I am.
Well, I don't think they bought it at 40. They were not happy yesterday.
Oh, I got you. Yeah, I sold. I don't even know if I've talked about my Bitcoin experience on here, but I was buying. I would buy $100 every time I got paid, and thinking, you know, if the thing takes off, great. If not, you know, big deal. And when it acted so poorly when we had that bout of inflation, and everybody said it was going to be a great inflation hedge, I was like, I give up on this thing. So I got out of it at about $35,000. I might end up looking smart at some point. And I have a funny feeling. Did you ask the waitresses if they own pure Bitcoin, or do they own an ETF or any of those other things?
I don't think they even have a brokerage. I think they just buy it from the ATM.
Well, I'm looking at the institutional holdings of the iShares Bitcoin Trust, and I have a funny feeling this thing is widely held by individuals.
Well, I bet it is too.
The biggest holder only has 2% of it. And typically when you're looking at something like that, you'll see, you know, a couple of very, you know, if you're looking at, heck, I'll look at the silver one real quick, and I'll bet you that there are there's more institutional holding there.
Well, we have a big holding in the SLV.
Yeah.
And we're not exactly Merrill Lynch.
No, because that's I always felt like that was one of the best ways to go about getting exposure to the to silver for individuals. SLV ETF. That's why I've always liked when I've had students at the university that are interested in the metals. I say, well, take a look at those two ETFs because they're, you know, the easiest things for you guys to trade, et cetera.
Well, I just never, when I walk by the few I've seen, there's, like Kevin was saying, if I walk by a couple of the Bitcoin ATMs, I just never even give a thought to how many people are ponying up 100 a week or 150 a week into the thing. I mean, I have no clue.
You know, I know somebody that bought 20 Bitcoin from one of those machines when it was about $20.
Did they have the machines back then?
Yeah, they had, you know, the between where you are and the old Cebo, I guess we have to call it the old Cebo floor now. You know, there was that that convenience store that you could get smoking materials at and all kinds of different kind of crap. Well, they had a Bitcoin ATM in there, and so he decided to go put a 20 in it or something like that. And but he had, like, he walked around with a paper 20 Bitcoin for a long time. I don't know if he still has it or not, but I hope he does.
Well, I had
for his sake, I hope he does.
We first started the show. I know, Kevin, I don't know if you were on, but I actually went online and I had a few people. We almost were going to buy one because it's a really high end ATM that you can also use it. It also works as a regular ATM, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, they were, you know, multiple thousand dollars, but you know, they claimed they were making dough. And by the way, you made money at it. You could pay bills. I mean, it was quite a machine. I don't know if it was made by Diebold or somebody, but it was somebody real. And we thought about it. I think we kind of laughed it away. But you know, the two, boy, I don't know. I'm walking out on a plank here, but in the area where my brother used to live, the two ATM machines were in. There's like three food stores, and one is populated more from people from not quite in the neighborhood, if you want to say that, and one was in the currency exchange. That's where they were. So they were not in the store where all the wealthier people from Beverly would shop. They were in the other places, which I thought was kind of bizarre.
Kind of sketchy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just thought it interesting. I'm not saying they shouldn't be everywhere or they should be nowhere, but saying it struck me as it was like right next to the lottery machine. And I just wondered.
Yeah, that's kind of how I was describing where Marty went and bought his.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I was going to say, sounds appropriate next to the lottery machine to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, the biggest scratch off now is now up to $50.
Jeez.
I was in there. I was talking with the guy about the daily lotto 2 weeks ago, and it was only 100 grand, and if it's over 250, I buy $2 worth, right? This guy walks in, buys his pack of cigarettes, and he goes, give me two of the 50s, two of the 30. He was like, $280, scratched them off, not a winner, and walked out the door, and I'm going, it was just $280. I'm like, good Lord. I mean, you know, I might have the 280, but if I ever do that, please put me in jail or in some home or something.
We'll just put you down.
Yeah, it's fine. Just put me down. I mean, and the, guy thought nothing of it. I'm like,
my kids have instructions on when to put me down, and one of them is, if you ever see me walking around in shorts with sandals and black knee socks, put me down.
We actually have an agreement here. If it looks like I'm having a major event, that she's supposed to set a timer for 15 minutes before she calls an ambulance.
Oh God!
Yeah, just go ahead and let it work itself out.
Speaking of shorts, what is the new phenomenon? It's not so new. When I go to the Myers in the morning at 8 o'clock, and it's 5 below 0, there'll be 3 or 4, shall we say, heavy guys walking around in shorts and a hoodie. No socks. I mean, what is the deal with that? I mean,
they've got natural layers,
I guess. But I mean, it's a look of some kind. I don't know exactly what the story is. And I don't know. On the way in this morning, here's one. Andrew and I are walking by the fire station. I'm in front of the fire station, there's a pair of somebody's pants. And I'm going, Andrew, do you think what? The guy had an extra. The guy had an extra pair and changed them here and left the old.
They found a better pair. You know, kind of like in the Wild West when you'd shoot somebody and then you'd see if their boots fit you or not.
Oh God! Remember that
somebody had, you know, kind of ratty pants and they came across a situation where they had better pants.
Do you remember the opening?
Don't want to say how it happened.
Yeah. Do you remember the opening scene in the
pair of underwear? That would have been a little weird.
Yeah, full change of clothes.
You guys remember the opening scene in the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance?
Don't remember it.
Where Jimmy Stewart walks in, and it's essentially John Wayne's funeral, right? So he opens up the casket, and he says to the Undertaker, "Hey, Clute, where are his boots?" And he goes, and the guy goes, "Well, they were pretty new boots. He's not going to need them. Clute, put his boots back on." They made the guy put the boots back on the body of the casket, and Clute, put the boots back on. The guy was a senator, Jimmy Stewart. Anyway, so Russell, what is? I know he's not one of your most. I think he's not. I'll make sure. Ray Dalio.
What a scumbag!
I know you're going to say that, but I read the article yesterday.
Have you ever read about how he treats people?
I
just want to. He. You know. You remember when? They had that thing in D.C. where there was some Native American guy getting in the face of some white high school student, and one of the people from CNN said, you know, just looking at that kid, he's just got a face that you'd want to punch. That's what I always think when I see Ray Dalio.
Okay. Having said that, I probably, since I pretty much agree with you on most things, even though I never do on the show, and if Jose Canseco, I don't think it'd be a guy I'd want to sit there and have 15 beers with, but if the guy started talking about steroids, I'm going to listen, right? Because he knows a lot about steroids. I mean, but the reason what caught my eye on this is the he's in somewhere, Emirates, talking about that the world was on the brink of a capital war, and I'd never heard that term before. And he was talking about that a lot of the issues that are being sown back and forth country to country is people are not. And the reason why this article hit me was because it's the same day that the three of the stocks that I'm protecting for people were all down 10%. And they're all in this international consulting kind of world. Mm-hmm. So my thought was, does he have a point here? And he's talking about that we are essentially, he said there's a fear among European holders of U.S. denominated assets that they could be sanctioned. There could be reciprocal fear on the part of the United States. They could not get the capital, or we not get them to buy from us. That somehow, if this gets bad enough, I mean, we owe Europe what, $1.8 trillion,
something like that. Yeah.
So, I mean, are they? And you know, don't want to go into this. We have a guy in the White House that for 80 years has made a thing about not paying people. You know, I don't think he's going to do it with our stuff, but matter of fact, I would think
I kind of wish he would. I wish he would suspend debt payments just to China. And you want to know why? Because China still owes us money.
Okay.
A lot of people don't realize that. And well, when one of the international norms, like, okay, let's say the communists win in the United States, they want to take over, because there's a good group of people in the U.S. right now. There's probably a minority that would love for us to turn into a communist country. If you completely change the government, internationally, the new government is responsible for the old government's debts. And when the Chinese Communist Party took over, they reneged on all of the previous government's debts. The only nation that has been paid out by China is Great Britain. And the way they got paid out was they said, we will hold to our agreement to give you Hong Kong back, but you got to make good on the debt payments you haven't paid us out on yet.
Okay,
so
now, okay.
Don't, you know, it's not like, you know, we're the only ones that owe everybody a bunch of money.
Right, now,
and we're probably more likely to pay people back.
All right. Define the term us.
The United States, our country.
Okay.
If unless you're like a globalist. And borders don't mean anything to you.
The reason why I asked that question is because I did this, I have no idea. One of my clients had some friends that had some of these old-time bearer bonds from these countries. Mm-hmm. Are German and Mexican. Mm-hmm. There are Santa Ana bearer bonds from Mexico. Okay, and there's all kinds. Matter of fact, I got pictures of them here in the office of gold-backed in banks that are still exist in Germany, bearer bonds from the 20s and 30s that Hitler said we're not paying. Now the difference, though, Russell. You talk about our government. The reason why I said us, they don't owe the U.S. They owe individual people, and our government, despite what parties in office, doesn't give a rat's ass about individual people. So if you, the Supreme Court said that basically, even though they were sold in this country and had whatever the CIPIC number was before it was an SEC, they said those are no good. After Hitler was the guy who said they're no good. So our government doesn't care. When you say, now, if somebody here owes a Chiang Kai-shek bond, do you think Trump or Biden or anybody gives a shit?
No, not at all.
So when you said us, who's us? I mean, these companies are still in existence in Germany. And by the way, the bank is supposed to have the gold depositor there. They're still in existence. But if you and I own the bond, nobody cares. Now, if the government owned it, maybe they'd think differently of it. But the government didn't own it. Individual people bought it. Now, I still have phone numbers. If you want to get a Maximilian bond from 1890, I can find you one. It's worth nothing.
You know what I have on the wall at my home office? A Soldier Field bearer bond. The original from 1930.
Boy, you guys have got me off on stories. You know the dumbest trade I didn't make ever was the Chicago Skyway bonds. The Chicago Skyway was built, I'm going to say, in the mid to late 50s. And I remember taking a ride on it with my uncle when it started. When I was a little kid. And 5 years later, they opened to Dan Ryan, which was free. The expressway basically running right next to it. So they had never made an interest payment, ever, from 1950 to... And I think they were 40-year bonds, 30 or 40.
On the Skyway?
Chicago Skyway.
Now, yeah, I could see that.
When you look at municipal bonds, and I used to know a lot about this, but now I don't, even though I know enough to do trades for people, but I don't. When you walk through, there's general obligation debt. I mean, if we had a municipal bond person, they know all this better than me. There's general obligation bonds, which means the city has to pay. Then there's stuff like the sanitary district, which actually is a different thing on your tax bill, and all those kinds of. And there's something called, and I forget the name. Russell, help me out if you get where they're something obligation bonds, where they're not legal obligations, but because your name is on it, cities don't like to let them go under. So even though the Chicago Skyway bonds never paid interest, and they were trading on like 15 or 18 cents on the dollar. When they started to come due, I had this feeling, you know, Citi is going to make these things good. You're never going to get your interest, but you're going to get your...
But you're going to get the principal.
You're going to get the principal back. Yeah. And I kept thinking it, never did much, trading on the floor every day. Sure enough, one day Mayor Daley makes the deal to sell the Skyway to these people. And the first thing they did was made the bondholders essentially whole without the interest. So I don't know who, where you could have found them, where they were traded, if there was some firm here that did it or not, if I could have found them. Somebody somewhere went and got those things at 17 and 18 cents on the buck and got 100. And no interest was ever paid. But you know, something like that. But, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of these little stories all over the place. And the stuff overseas, anyway, just to expand on the thing in Europe a little bit, what I was trying to do for these people is find if these things were fungible anywhere. And what happened during the 30s was that Germany could not afford to pay France and Britain. This is part of the reason why the Weimar Republic inflated the currency. They could not really afford to pay France and Britain the reparations from Versailles. I mean, Versailles pretty much caused World War II, in my mind, economically anyway. I don't know if your opinion on that, but...
Oh, no, it did.
So then...
it was it gave Germans the reason to be angry.
Yeah, and France and Britain, we charged them for all the stuff we lent them for World War I. Not like World War II, we didn't really get it back. World War I, we were demanding to get it back. So Germany is paying France and Britain. France and Britain is paying us. Meanwhile, we are allowing... I don't even know if they were through brokerage firms... Germany to sell these bonds in the U.S. to individual people. So people here are buying bonds from Germany. The money's going to France, and that money's going to our government. Talk about a circle jerk. And so our people were essentially funding our own government without knowing it. I mean, this is you couldn't write fiction like this. You'd never sell a book. And then our guys got reneged on the bonds.
Yeah, well, you know, in a very similar thing, do you know, I recently, within the past few months, learned that when we bought Alaska from Russia, when we bought Alaska from Russia, basically they gave us Alaska and we forgave some debt.
Yeah.
It's like we paid them, you know, $100 and then they gave us the $100 back and Alaska, but to save face, they made it look like they had sold it to us. I'm sure lots of things like that.
Look at the Louisiana Purchase. That land isn't even ours. The treaty from Spain to France was, if you ever sell it, we have the right of first refusal. France turned around and sold it to us.
Well, then maybe they should buy it from us, or at least take Southern California.
Well, that wasn't part of it. Where's your geography?
But not San Diego. I'm just trying to get rid of some things I think we should get rid of.
You know, hey, San Diego, the weather in San Diego looks pretty nice compared to here.
Yeah, you don't want San Diego, but then, you know, just carve above it a little bit. So
whatever. So what is the market telling you? Yesterday I mentioned the part about the consulting firms all getting their ass kicked. Today AMD's down 10%. We had PayPal yesterday down, 10-15%. Yet some companies are up. What is it telling you? The volatility in the gold and silver, I think the volatility has to...
I haven't been able to prove this one yet, because I just don't automatically believe things that people tell me without doing the whole trust to verify thing. But I heard a pundit say every time silver makes a parabolic move, within 6 months we get a 20% correction on the equity market. That it has been a canary in the coal mine, and they said going back to 1970, and it had happened 5 times, and I think I found the 5 times, but I just couldn't back into what they said equity performance wise. But logically, that does make a lot of sense to me, that you start to see volatility in a couple of assets that people think of as somewhat safe havens, especially gold. And, you know, if people are charging into that, that means that they are, you know, and they're charging into an asset that doesn't do anything for you. You know, it doesn't, other than maybe go up in price. You know, Buffett always had a good point about gold. It doesn't pay a dividend. It doesn't earn any cash for you. And that's why he always kind of shied away from it as an investment. But it is a good investment when you're a bit concerned about turbulence in the world and et cetera. And I put my conspiracy theory hat on this one. You know, we talk about the biggest holders of our debt, and China was the biggest holder of our debt. And they've sold about $1 trillion in our debt over the past year or two. And their gold holdings have gone up tremendously. So I think they've been cashing in our debt and buying gold because they see a more dangerous world going forward.
I think that I'll dig this up here because I have it. We've been talking about it with everybody, but we dig this up. And the interesting part is our leader continues to beat up on these people in Europe. They have picked up. Europe has picked up the entire decrease in the Chinese thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at China mainland, okay? I'm doing 2024, yeah. 11. Notice how quick I picked this up because we've been talking about it. China used to be number one. You're right. Now number one is Japan.
Yeah.
In the last year, they have added. They're $1.2 trillion. They've added $125 billion in the last year. China mainland is 682. They're down from 768, so they're down $106 billion. Britain went from 766 to 888, so they've essentially picked up dollar for dollar what China has dropped. Canada has gone from 372 to 472, and we can't wait to tell those guys what assholes they are. They've picked up the entire ball from China. And all we do is bitch about them. I don't get the story there. France has gone from 332 to 376. Luxembourg 417, 420. So the entire European continent, who we appear to want to vilify on a daily basis, has got to be up $500 to $600 billion in the last year, and an amount they've lent us to keep our whatever ship we've got going here afloat. I mean, do our people read these numbers before they start to open their mouth?
They do. I feel like we've reached a fatigue thing with respect to debt. You know, I'm almost 60 now, and I can remember in college professors talking about how our national debt was unsustainable, blah blah blah, and eventually my generation would pay the piper. Well, I don't think my generation is going to. My generation's almost done now. And we've just passed it on to the next one. I don't know what it is that's got. I think what it would really take is if we lose our status as a reserve currency, which a lot of people would like, a lot of entities would like to see. That's why they came up with the euro, but the euro is not going to do it. If anything, I think the euro might go in the opposite direction. China, they just recently flipped some of the debt that one of the African countries owed them from U.S. dollars to Chinese yuan and offered them a big discount if they would choose to do it that way. I can't quite figure out why they would make that move unless, again, they're trying to make their currency the reserve currency. They accepted or they made a payment for oil once in Chinese yuan, which was supposed to be very significant. But I just can't see the world, if you have a choice between our currency and China's currency, and say what you want about what our Federal Reserve does and everything, but there's no transparency with respect to what China is doing with their currency. And I know that some of their national banks are allowed to create their own currency. So you really don't know how much of that one is outstanding. And even if they give you a number, there's no way that you're going to believe it because they've been less than honest with their economic activity. They've been less than honest with a lot of things. So who's going to, and I've heard there's grumblings of, the BRICS country creating their own currency together. Take a look at the euro with a lot of developed countries that already had, that had some problems where you had a difference between the economy in Greece and the economy in Germany, and how do you set an interest rate for those two divergent economies? It's even worse for the BRICS because you've got China and India, which are net importers of energy, and then you've got Russia, which is a net exporter of energy. Their economies are more diverse relative to each other than the ones that comprise the euro. So I don't even think they could get a BRICS currency launched. So, you know, what is the alternative to the U.S. dollar?
I don't.
And is crypto? Crypto's not going to be. I think we've already seen that. That you know, the widespread adoption of crypto is not going to happen anytime soon. I mean, people own it for speculative purposes, or to you know, if you want to knock off your neighbor because they've encroached on your property or something, you can go use some Bitcoin to pay a hitman. But there's not a real great, you know, or to pay ransoms, etc. But there's not a really great use of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency like, you know, the use of the U.S. dollar.
Well, I think the difference in way you and I look at this is, well, first of all, you've got way more education than me, but the you're from the sort of the business, whatever, your view of currencies, your training in this has been a little different than mine. So we come about it differently. Whenever I talk to someone like you, I don't talk to too many PhDs, but when I do, they always talk about the dollar in terms of international stuff, whether it's better or worse than the Chinese, which you just did, the euro, and what about Bitcoin? And you look at it that way. I rarely look at it that way. Mm-hmm. I look at it as, is your currency for you individually and for me and for the average American who really, it's not like I don't care about the rest of the world, but I really care more about you and Kevin than I knew about somebody I'd never met, right? I look at what we're doing to our own people, and I'm appalled. Because the dollar in my pocket, I don't really, to be honest with you, I use some French here, I don't really give a shit what it does versus the Saudi God knows what. I care about it, what it means for you and me and Kevin and Carl and the listeners versus the car in the street you're trying to buy. And we're decimating that.
Purchasing power, yeah.
We're decimating that. And that somehow or another isn't even on the table on CNBC, on Fox Business, any discussion. That's the problem. I look at my pick-me-up mm-hmm. that I bought 2 years ago for $10,300 that I couldn't, with 2 years wear and tear and salt on it, I couldn't duplicate that today for $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's my issue with the currency and our policy. And to say that as long as we maintain we're the cleanest person in the room, but guess what? We just all went through a mud bath. It doesn't make us clean.
Nah.
I mean, I'm looking at the numbers here, and I don't. And by the way, I agree with you. If you were teaching, or I was teaching 10 years ago, and said, "Boy, we're going to walk off a cliff." Well, in some ways, we have. If you put your money in a bank, if you put $1 million in the bank 10 years ago, and look at the interest rates between now and then and what you've earned, I'm going to say you probably have $1.2 million compounded, because it was like 0 or 1% for a while. And I'm going to say your $1.2 million is now worth $600 compared to what it was 10 years ago. I don't think you gained, and I think that's a problem.
No, you haven't.
But I'm looking at this, though, what you just mentioned. 1960, now we still had a lot of war debt, okay? 1960, debt to GDP was 53%. I'm sure people were appalled at that. 1980, mm-hmm. it got down to 34%. 2000, 59. Guess what it is today?
We're over 100.
121.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm gonna roll with you on the fact that we haven't come to the cliff yet. Can that number be 160? Can it be 180? I don't know. I mean, Japan was up there for a while, and somehow they managed to stay in business.
Right, it's catching up with them right now.
Yeah,
so I mean, which is a little worrisome. I've always thought of Japan as, you know, they've got a high level of debt, they don't have a whole lot of growth, they have no inflation whatsoever, and everybody seems fairly happy there. And I've always felt like, you know, from the high level economist thing, well, we want growth, we want inflation, et cetera. But if you know, people seem to be living their lives and fairly happy with the way that they're living their lives, you know. So what that they don't have inflation and they've got a lot of debt, but the debt is I guess that would be, it appears that that may be catching up with them. In fact, a couple of weeks ago when everybody said the stock market was all nervous over Trump and Greenland, I actually think it was nervous about some things that were going on in the Japanese bond market.
I'm with you absolutely on that.
I really think people, I even did a video on it for Larissa and I's video channel, just talking about what had happened in that market. And it happened overnight, and it happened when a lot of stuff was going on in Europe. And apparently the business networks can only talk about one thing at a time. And so they decided that it was
They don't want to talk about anything real.
No, I actually had a CNBC reporter say to me when I told him that they should be saying something slightly different when they talk about VIX, that their audience wasn't smart enough to keep up with that.
I got a CNBC story from way back, but our buddy John Lee, who comes on every other Monday, mm-hmm. and he's kind of, he and you guys, the Bodias, as they say on the South Side, are my world traveler eyes and ears around the world, right? And he was in Japan, I'm going to say 3-4 months ago for a week or two. I don't know what the hell he was doing over there, but he goes, I think he said this a few Mondays ago. He goes, don't believe any of this stuff. He goes, you talk to an individual Japanese guy, they are apeshit about the inflation.
Yeah.
He goes, don't think for a second there's no inflation over there.
I saw a thing on this, and I thought it was almost fascinating that, like, there are certain products that were tied to their prices, like 99-cent tea, you know, or whatever, you know, 99 won or yen tea or whatever. But I mean, because they had been the exact same price for people's lifetimes.
Well,
and they're kind of like the Costco hot dog thing where they had to budge off the Costco $1 hot dog or whatever. But across the board in Japan. Yeah, Japan's looking at about 250% debt to GDP. And the reason 3 weeks ago that their bond market acted fairly poorly was inflation concerns. And it has to do with an election that's coming. In fact, I think their election is this Sunday, which will give me something to watch this Sunday, because I'm boycotting the Super Bowl.
Why is that?
Like, they care, but just halftime performance, all that kind of stuff. Plus, I'm just souring toward sports across the board. You know what? Just go to the ESPN homepage and tell me how many of the top headlines have to do with somebody cheating, taking drugs, some dude punching out a girl, or somebody getting a DUI last night. I'm sick of these people.
As my buddy, my attorney buddy said,
my thing with sports is I'm going to care as much about those teams as they care about me, and they don't care about me.
Oh, they don't care about you.
Yeah, nobody cares about me.
There is no we in Bears.
No, there is not. There might be an N in Bears, as in Indiana.
Well, you know, here's my.
I really hope they move that team down here.
I would. Here's my take on it. It's been my take for a long time.
Hope they move that team down here.
Down where? You don't live in Gary?
In Indiana. I live in Indiana.
You're not Gary.
No, I'm a Hoosier.
Oh God.
Yeah, the Hoosier Bears.
You want your state to give
you? We can do a man bear pig. It could be the Northern Indiana man bear pigs.
Why as a professor and a citizen of the world? I'll ask you this quick question, then we'll go to break. Where's Larissa? This is a question for her. Why is it when I've heard probably 10 times now on various TV and radio stations that Indiana wants to build a stadium, lease it to the Bears with an option to buy. Okay.
Yeah, and then they can walk away years when Chicago builds them a new stadium.
Well, okay, but I sit there and go, I know that I should have become an electrician or something and never gone to school, because all of that just pops up a million questions for me. Aren't we forgetting something? How much is the place going to cost? How much is the lease? Is it going to cover any of the costs? Mm-hmm. And when they come to buy it, is the price they're going to buy it anywhere near what it costs other people to build it? Aren't those the questions that you can't just kind of leave off the table?
What are the pure economics behind it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's got to be a belief that it's some one way or another, it's going to cover itself. Now, one thing that I can... It's got to be cheaper to build a place in Gary.
How much
than
cheaper?
Anywhere in the Chicago area.
How much cheaper? Hmm? How much cheaper?
Well, just I'm thinking of the property. You know, the Arlington Heights thing fell apart because they, you know, they thought they had a tax agreement in place and they didn't.
When hey, let's go to break. When we come back, I want to expand on that because it has to do with people's view of the world and and you know. You're in several different places, so you have a better view of this than I do. I'm just in my one spot. Anyway, S&P futures up 8, NASDAQ futures down 70. We're pretty quiet after yesterday's sell-off. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How would you like to save money on nearly all your prescription drugs? We've set up a special toll-free number for the RX Outreach Program. They're a nonprofit company whose mission it is to make prescription drugs more affordable to the masses. They don't take insurance, and in many cases, your prescriptions are even cheaper than your co-pays. They carry thousands of different prescription drugs, so whatever you're taking, there's a good chance they have it. No coupons are required, and this is not a discount card. It is pure savings on your prescription drugs. They specialize in generic meds for any chronic health needs you have. Call with your prescription and find out for free how little you can pay for your prescription drugs. Remember, we don't take insurance, so call right now.
800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. That's 800-586-9885.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 8, and NASDAQ futures down 69. Pretty quiet morning, considering the last couple days are anything but quiet. Dow futures up 130. What do we got going on the Dow? We've got Home Depot up $1.80. Yesterday, with the market going in the crapo most of the day, matter of fact, at one point it looked like we were going to crash, for God's sake. Walmart was up, Home Depot was up, and all kinds of other stocks were down 10%. So we're not only getting movement in the averages, we're getting up and down movements within the market, which is really hard to explain. I mean, there must be an explanation someplace, but it's not readily apparent to me. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 83.3%, FTSE up 121, that's a full percent. Santander falls nearly 12% amid plan to buy U.S. bank Webster for $12 billion. I don't even know who Webster is. Maybe Russell does. CAC around up 74.9%. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 427.8%. Hang Seng up 12%. Let's call that flat. Shanghai up 34.8%. So Shanghai actually been a little volatile lately. They usually aren't. Bonds unchanged at 4.28. Bonds have been steady. The Bund unchanged at 287. Not much going on there. And Japan is up to 225. They're getting close to the Bund, which man, Muscle and I would probably never thought it was going to happen. Oil up 15 cents, 63.36. So it looks like the days of 57 of a few weeks ago might be over. So now our new range is probably 61 to 65. Brent up 12 cents, 67.45. Natural gas up 7 cents, 3.38. It did get up to almost 6 at one point. So it's come down quite a bit from there. Gold up 135, over 5,000 again, 5,070. Silver up 8%, $6.90. Again, Russell and I were talking about this, $90.22. Foreign exchange, pound at 118. But the interesting one here is sterling versus the pound versus euro. So British is hitting a five-month high versus the euro. So there's a big movement there, not just against the dollar. British pound, again, we're 137. Pound's 137 versus the dollar. Crypto, down 453 to Bitcoin. To 75,000. Again, we're going to talk to Russell about what's going on with MicroStrategies and are they a canary in a coal mine here with their Bitcoin stuff. And this Ethereum is down another 2%. These guys are down to 22.19. They've been down like almost every day. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
All right, it is 7:36 here in Chicago, Wednesday, February 4th. Just a little bit of sports, nothing too exciting as the Bulls lost to the Bucks, 131 to 115. But the Suns did win over the Trailblazers, 130 to 125. Chicago weather is currently 23 degrees. We're going to have a high of 27 today. Getting mostly cloudy today, just a tiny little bit of sun that's not really going to warm things up. And maybe a little bit of snow as well, but thankfully it's not going to stick. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 55 degrees. They're going to have a high of 86, which is unseasonably warm. And they're going to be, I believe it's almost a record high if it does reach 86. And then finally, for Chicago traffic, things have built up a whole lot from our first hour. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 33 minutes. If you're coming in from O'Hare, it's going to take you 50. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 49 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 45. The Dan Ryan from the 95th is going to take you 29 minutes. And Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 34 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you.
Russell, how far away is Andrew from being like our favorite lady producer, Angelica? Bulls lose to somebody. Who cares? All they do is lose. Do we have Russell? Do we lose Russell?
Sorry, I was yelling at the dog. Sorry.
Now the dog is perfectly behaved since you yelled at him.
Oh, they are. No, they. She was. I'm trying to get her in from outside.
Oh,
so that's all. Trying to give her a break during our break. First off, Webster is a TV show with Alex Karras. I don't really know about Webster Bank.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I've never heard of Webster Bank.
Yeah, I haven't either. I mean,
the second you said Webster, that's what I thought of. And then what I was trying to do is because you mentioned MicroStrategy, and I had a student ask me about it yesterday, trying to look at their balance sheet and figure out. But I've only got a balance sheet through 2024, so I'm not. And I know they bought more Bitcoin in 2025, so I don't really have a good idea as to how much of the loss is their losses on Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin's down about 30 or 40%, and their stock is down 70.
Yeah,
not about right. About 300 over 450. Yeah, about 60 to 70%. So you've got to assume that a good portion of that is the asset coming down, but in lots of other cases with respect to like ETFs or really exchange traded notes or other tradable products that give you indirect exposure to Bitcoin, the stock was probably trading at a big premium based on some anticipation that Bitcoin was going to keep going up.
Well, the rumors.
So they got double hit on it.
What do they say? The rumors on the murmurs in the mist, the rumors are their cost basis is about 76,000. So yesterday, so when the Bitcoin dropped down to 73 yesterday, that was almost like a little panic yesterday afternoon. And then between that and the House passing the funding bill, we kind of relieved. I mean, where the NASDAQ closed down 2-something, it was down damn near 4 at one point. It was looking really ugly. And then those two things happen. But the other murmur in the mist is they have control, leverage 600,000 Bitcoin is the number flying around. Like you, I'm not privy to their balance sheet, but that appears to be the whispered number, which is
they've got 55. I found it. They've got 55 billion, and their average cost is about $76,050.
Yeah, that's the same thing we were talking about yesterday.
Oh, 76,037. Yeah, that's even more exact.
So at like 50, they're not looking so hot.
Oh, no, they're not. And I'm actually, I'm honestly, in the back of my mind, if this thing gets back to the mid-30s, I might go back to buying $100 every time I get paid.
Well, I feel it's one of those things that I don't think it has any reason for being, so I don't know if there's a natural.
I don't either, but if for some reason, and you know, we like you always like to say, everything in the show relates to everything else. We spent a lot of time in the first half hour talking about currency. The crypto, one of the intent, the original intent behind Bitcoin, it came out in 2008, and it came out because some dude that understood technology very well and had a really good idea looked at what happened to the global financial system and felt like we needed an alternative. And that really was the original idea. And if you had a Kalshi market on what's more likely to become the next reserve currency, and you had, you know, the euro, the yen, some sort of brick creation or a crypto, I would say a crypto. That might not be one that's out right now, but eventually that's how money is going to, that what Bitcoin is now and everything being purely digital We're going to be there in a couple of generations.
That's
where we're going to get. It's, you know, it, and if you go to China, just about everybody in China pays each other with their iPhones. The way that they can tell that you're not a local, other than not being Chinese, when you're in the when you're in there negotiating for the knockoff purses and stuff, is if you're going to use your phone or if you're going to pay with cash. They think you're more savvy if you're going to be using your phone.
Well, they can think that all they want. You know.
Yeah, and they tried to get the same friend that we were talking about with that had some Bitcoin. He almost accidentally paid $250 U.S. for a T-shirt until I intervened.
Well,
because he was paying cash.
Again, it's the difference in your and my view of currencies and what the different courses we took. And I constantly try and say, well, the what's going on with the dollar, as you know, because you know we both have been criticizing for the last hour. I'm not happy with it. But and whether or not we're reserve currency or whatever, but two things come into play, and I know I have this article. It's classic currency article at home someplace. Where it's buried, I have no idea, Russell. But the quote is: at some point, every currency will drop to its intrinsic value.
Mm-hmm.
Intrinsic value, in other words, what's backing it. And I will absolutely agree with you 100%. Which I should, you know, we're never supposed to do. We're supposed to be jousting. And the fact that if we keep doing this, our government keeps doing this to the dollar, I absolutely, 10, 20 years from now, if you and I were going to come up with a currency, I mean, call it a Russell, and behind every dollar, whatever we want to call it, not a dollar, between any wampum or something, whatever you want to call it, a denarius, like was that the Roman coin? Behind every denarius was a gallon of oil. I think if people are still doing what they're doing with their fiat currencies, I think that thing, if became available like the Bitcoin system, which is pretty damn good, if every Bitcoin was worth a barrel of oil or something, or two barrels, or if there was gold or whatever else it was, or an acre of land in Saudi, even whatever it is, something behind it, where we could actually put your finger on it and say, wait a minute, give me my 50 barrels of oil, here's my 50 Bitcoin. I'm not saying I'd be all for it, but I could sure understand that. But the idea that we're going to create an artificial stock and just say, that's our stuff with nothing behind it, that's a reach. That to me is, from my situation, and there was a classic, the classic, you may have read this, if not, I'll try and find it, the classic currency study by somebody, and it wasn't currency, was done in prisoner of war camps, and where cigarettes became the currency.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was, we all, in cigarettes, had a, for you and me, I've never smoked. To me, they have no value whatsoever, but to most people that like to smoke, there's a value to a cigarette, correct?
Right.
So everything was off that. If you wanted a half a pint of booze, it was 20 cigarettes. If you wanted a new pair of underwear or something, it was 15. Everything was based on the cigarettes. So one day, somebody in the U.S. got there, I don't know if it was a patrol or whatever got there, and they liberated the prisoner of war camp. Well, the first thing they did was drop off 50 boxes of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what happened? Everything else, now there were all kinds of cigarettes, and guys went up to the dude with the pint of booze and say, here's my 20 cigarettes, and the guy goes, no, that ain't happening. It's now 40 cigarettes, you idiot, or something. I mean, it shifted just like, there's a basic principle to this, that all the people on TV, and seemingly like half the people in the Fed, including the chairman, don't seem to get. But there is a basic principle. Something its value is its scarcity, right?
Right.
And if we double the amount of money in circulation, it's just like a stock dividend, right? If I owe you
if I owe you
20 bucks, I now owe you 40 bucks. As simple as that, right? But somehow the basic knowledge of this seems wanting, and even our elected officials, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
No, we can write checks for COVID and send them out to people and make everybody wealthier. No, you didn't. Did you?
So You know who might be like-minded or has been in the past? I hope he sticks with being like-minded like this.
I mean, somebody who isn't dead?
Is Mr. Warsh.
Yeah, I'm saying I think he's a pretty good pick.
Yeah, he is. I got interviewed on Fox Business about it last week. And what I'm kind of hoping he did was I'm kind of hoping he interviewed with Trump, kind of convinced Trump that he would be easier than he had in the past, and he's going to get in there and go back and do what he wants to do.
I'm all for that.
I'm actually kind of hoping for that.
The problem is, if you're right, and I sure as hell hope you are, I can't believe mm-hmm. Trump picked him.
See, I don't think if either this guy really changed his stripes, or just said what he needed to say to get the job.
Well, he may have
Joe versus the volcano. He can get the job, but can he do the job?
Well, he could very well. I mean, you and I could probably make the argument. Maybe Trump's so unread on this. You and I could make the argument that where is the rates now? 4.25. You and I could probably make the argument that the federal funds rates. What's it like? 4.25?
Oh, it's like 3.5. It's 3.75.
Okay, what I'm saying, you and I could make the argument. Yeah, we'll lower it to 3.5. All right. I mean, you and I could.
Which really doesn't do anything.
I'm saying, but I don't think he. Yeah. I don't. I mean, you get the feeling that Trump wants it at like 2. Well, you and I don't. You know, that's a whole different brand of ball. Somewhere in the 3.25, 3.75. To me, that's pretty neutral. I mean, I don't have a problem in there. Do you? I mean, I really don't. I mean,
No. I feel like this is kind of a mid-range number that they can work with in both directions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. If Powell doesn't want to go another quarter and he does, I have no bitch with that, really. But the only thing I think they're missing the part about somehow or another they have separated money supply versus interest rate, on both the theoretical and other, and there isn't. They're together, right?
And I feel like I think you know, and Warsh is focused on all of that, and he's very in the past. He's been. Have you ever heard the phrase Fed traditionalist?
Yeah, those are really old monetarist guys.
Yeah, that's what I feel like he's going to be. Hopefully, more like that.
Well, I mean, I would be.
He's talked about the Fed should not be involved in any kind of regulatory activity.
Oh, bull! Who's going to do it?
I don't know, but he thinks that the Fed has started to overstep some of the regulatory things.
I mean, does anybody even? You do. I mean, I'll prove it. You know this. Who's supposed to regulate banks?
Oh gosh, was it the OCC or something like that?
No.
Oh.
The huge money center banks, and I haven't heard, I don't even know who the hell the person is. Huge money center banks are supposed to be regulated by the Comptroller of Currency.
Okay, that's why I said OCC.
Okay, the other...
That's the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Yeah, I said it right.
But the other banks... Okay, I thought you meant OCC Option Clearing Corp.
Go ahead.
And then the next in line are the Federal Reserve regulates all other national banks.
Yeah,
and your state banks are regulated by the FDIC. That's the way it ought to. That's the way it traditionally has been. What it is today, I couldn't give a guess. Could you?
No, not particularly. Everybody steps in everybody's playground every once in a while.
They do all kinds of crap, with what's the stupid thing they do with the test, what happens if you go broke?
The stress test.
With all the crap they do to these people, they're totally unregulated. Do whatever they damn well please. We have two or three of them now that are way above what percentage of deposits you're supposed to have in a country.
Yeah. Right?
And nobody says, hey, you idiots are too big. You can't make it.
How are you going to scale that back down?
Or you can't, we won't let you buy another bank. When's the last time we turned down one of these?
Well, I think that to stay under that stress threshold, banks have been reluctant. A bank has been reluctant that doesn't have to adhere to that has been kind of reluctant to merge with somebody else that suddenly puts them in that category. I do think that's hurt bank at that level has hurt some of the bank consolidation.
Well, you're on the list for the stuff that Hal sends out, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, his, you know, Hal's been looking at, we all get the money supply numbers a month late, right? Which, as you know, infuriates the hell out of me, but we don't get the weeklies. But evidently, there still are weeklies that they fill in from the monthly we get, right? Which is sort of bizarre, but
well, they basically have the weekly and they don't share it until they give out the monthly.
But then they only do it like 1 week at a time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Hal has been doing a regression or whatever you want to call it, a log thing, on the weeklies instead of the monthlies, and the difference in, as of last one he's got us a year from now being a 11% growth. Now, if this guy gets in and says we're not doing that, it's going to be 3% growth, I'll applaud the guy in front of the mic. I mean, I don't see that happening, because the only thing keeping the market and everything up is his money pouring in. I don't. Boy, that would be a major change in tone. I can't imagine Trump appointing somebody that does that. Because whenever Powell tried to do it, he does is call him an idiot, right?
Yeah. So time will tell. And you know, watching the lack of a market reaction to all of this makes me think everybody's kind of like you and I are right now, as far as, is he gonna, you know, has he changed his stripes or not? You know, I can't wait for the first time we really get a nice speech out of him.
I'm going to say, if what you just said is true, the first meeting that he chairs, the people are going to go, who the hell is this guy? Where did he come from?
I'm hoping so.
Me too, but boy, that would be... That'd be like me walking in and saying, guess what, I'm running a marathon this afternoon. Good Lord. So what do you... we have talk a little shop. Everybody knows we do a lot of protection stuff for people and single stock issues, concentration issues. I tell you what, Russell, without naming the stocks, a lot of the stocks that we are managing for people are getting their ass kicked.
You're starting to see this really weird, you know, it's like a different sector each day, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you think?
It's like a selling rotation.
Well, I mean, some of the stocks I follow, is OMC is probably the second or third biggest international marketing firm. Whack, yeah. Whack, 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 whack. Yesterday they were down 10%. Accenture, I know people used to work there, so I have it up on my screen. Why, I don't know. 10% yesterday. They're consulting. IBM, which has been really strong, was down 10% before it rallied back a little bit yesterday. I'm sitting there, okay, what do these three stocks have in common? They all do a lot of international consulting. Is there some missive that I missed here that somebody says that all of a sudden...
Oh, the thing with there was a handful of stocks that got hit on this thinking that what they do is going to be replaced in the type of work that they do for other businesses, where IBM with consulting, Ogilvy and Myers for advertising, and what was the first one you mentioned?
OMC and then Accenture.
All three of those companies benefit from expertise that they use to help out other businesses, and there is a growing belief that AI is going to replace that. That I'm going to be able to use AI to create my own, you know, my own ads and throw them out on social media, as opposed to having to rely on Ogilvy and Meyer. Or, you know, we can create some AI tools internally very easily, and we don't really need as much out of a company like Accenture or IBM. That's why software companies got hit so hard yesterday as well. Why do you need software solutions for things when you can get AI, where you can simply set up an AI protocol that will do that for you?
Well, there was a group, and again,
so that was kind of the theme for some of the big sell-off yesterday. Was AI, what is AI going to replace?
Well, there was a group, I listened to this on BBM, and they, some of their business stuff is pretty good. They had a guy from a firm, it wasn't Challenger Grand Christmas, it was, I thought it was Forrest and something, but who knows.
Forrester.
And they analyzed all the layoffs in the last 6 to 8 weeks, and there's been a boatload that have been announced, right? Amazon, everybody else. They said 66% of the places that laid people off and gave AI as the reason, don't even have AI. It was just the excuse.
Is this their bullshit? Yeah. And I think hiring has slowed a bit as people don't want to hire folks and then figure out AI can do what they hired the person for in 3 to 6 months and then have to let them go. I do think there's been some slow, just in general for some of the things that we hear talking to employers around here.
Kevin talked a lot about the, I'll get it up here, the ISM report this month, and how it was the first time we were over 50 in a while, and how it looked like there was some progress in a lot of stuff, and they got, I mean, some of the stuff is that customer inventories are way down. Prices they got not going up, which is, I don't know about that. They've got the backlog popped up for a second. New export orders popped up for a second. Pretty much everything through the whole thing, imports are actually up too, which are people's... it's actually a pretty darn good report for a January, and I don't know how the pricing part influences this. If they actually talk about units, or they talk about the price times the amount of units, which I think is not as good. But is it a 1 month blip because it's been so lousy? The part about the customer inventories being down, are they down because they think there's not going to be any business, or are they down because they don't have enough and they better start ordering? You never really know on this stuff, do you?
Right. Maybe inventory's down a bit. Yeah, after the COVID thing, there were just so many concerns about, about supply chains, et cetera, and reworking them. And maybe you had more inventories as you went through that process, and maybe we're closer to the end of that process now, where everybody's kind of reworked their supply chains and are a bit more comfortable with having lower inventories and having nothing to do with potential economic outlook, et cetera.
Well, your just in time only works if the people can get it there just in time, right?
Right, right.
I mean,
one component of that can logjam the whole thing.
Well, yeah, and it's been a more. For those that don't kind of know what we're talking about, is one of the first, wasn't one of the first automobile plants to do that was Belvedere, right?
The one in Belvedere. I think so, yeah.
So the idea of just in time, and I think I'm preaching to the crowd here, but the idea is you don't have the tire guy deliver you 90 bazillion tires in inventory. You have them deliver them every day, and you need, if you're doing 25
it's like
tires.
It's like a 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
There's a Target that's really close to campus at Purdue, and it's like a smaller, it's probably closer to a Walgreens size than a Target. And my daughter, who's down at Purdue, says that if you don't go before like 10 a.m., you're not going to find the things that you need because they restock it. Everybody runs over there. It's like the only place that's convenient for most people to get the kind of things you get at Target. Whenever we go see Emmy over at Purdue, we're taking her to the bigger Target off campus to get her stuff. But that's, they're doing just-in-time inventory there, but they don't have a big enough place to hold the inventory, and they don't have the ability to restock throughout the day. It's kind of a funny business case on they could do so much better if they had more space.
Well, yeah, the just-in-time is, if you're doing 25 cars a day, somebody shows up with, 100 tires a day. Well, I guess make that 125 if you got a spare. And they bring it right out to the line, and you slap them on. Well, yeah. The problem is,
you don't want that stuff sitting around. That stuff sitting around is actually money that's not being used.
But it's also, if one day the guy's caught in a snowstorm, you got 20 cars sitting on the, 25 cars sitting on a line you can't drive off. So that's a problem, too. Mm-hmm. And if you multiply that by how many thousand parts, you got to be careful.
It's going to catch up with you, yeah.
Or not, depending on how good you are. I mean, it's a...
Yeah.
Matter of fact, when I was out in Marengo, the railroad that goes through Marengo and goes out to, actually, Galena, was the oldest railroad out of Chicago. Chicago and Galena. Not many people know that. But now, almost the sole purpose, although I think they're going to put a commuter line in that thing, Russell, I don't know if you knew that or not. The sole purpose of the railroad, there might be a few other people along the line, is the service that Belvedere plant.
That's what it was out there. Yeah.
And it's well, I mean, the thing was built in the 1860s, long before there was a plane.
Yeah.
You know what that was for? You probably do. But what was it? What were in Galena?
There was golf. I don't know.
Before golf, there were tin mines, evidently.
Oh, really? Okay. No, I didn't know that. You know, I didn't grow up in Chicago.
Oh, I didn't know. I mean, I heard a rumor there was silver mine, or where it was tin. I mean, does anybody even mine tin anymore? I guess you do. I don't know.
You do in Africa. You do, you, because it's such a low cost thing.
Yeah. What do you use tin for?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know.
I do know that it's still, you know, that it's still mined, but it's so cheap. Yeah. That you have to do it where the labor cost is very low as well.
Well, you remember that the Three Stooges, but we'll end on this. You remember the Three Stooges scene when they're in the bar, and they ordered the stuff, and it was it old Homicide, right? So Curly, yeah. Curly drops some on the bar and eats through the varnish. So then they take the shot, and the guy goes, "It'll be like whatever." And Larry says, "Hey, buddy, it's a tin roof." The guy goes, "What do you mean a tin roof? It's on the house." So that's my Three Stooges line of the day. It's a tin roof.
Oh my goodness!
It's on the house. Are you a Three Stooges fan?
I remember them from back in the day after school, eating my snack. Oh, that's God. What I remember them for.
Well, you know, every male personality is included there, right?
Pretty much.
There's,
yeah.
There's the guy who has to be in charge, the guy who's the goofball, and the guy who just wants everybody to get along.
Exactly.
Anyway, all right, but
I'm the get along guy.
Well, no, that's not bad. Well, you'd be Larry Fine, Larry Fine.
I'll be Larry Fine.
I don't know if he wear cardigans. I don't know if he did or not. Just saying. Hey,
depend on the situation.
How's school going? You guys good?
School's good. I got really good students this semester. Things are going well. Nobody's making me mad.
Well, good. Good for you. Hope yeah, we have a yeah. Hope we have our friend back next week.
Yeah, I think she'll be back around. She had a couple of meetings this morning, well, so good. Wasn't able
she's,
to make it.
She's very popular, but she is our lightning rod on where that age is and what she's teaching. She certainly has a point of view that we miss when she's not here, because you and I are too professorial.
We're too old.
Well, that could be too.
We're just grumpy old men.
S&P futures up 2, NASA futures down 107. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.